Chapter 84. 4 months passed quickly. Sean, distracted by the responsibilities of his office, the mountains of correspondence, the meetings and sessions, the petitioners and the schemers, offered only a token resistance to Michael's sugar plans. Michael went off to the coast, purchased the land, and became deeply involved with the seller's eldest daughter. This young lady had the dubious distinction of being one of the few divorcees in Natal. When the scandal reached his ears, Sean, secretly pleased that Michael's chastity was at last shed, boarded the rolls and went off on a flying mission of rescue. He returned to Lady Burke with a penitent Michael in tow. 2 weeks later, the young lady married a travelling salesman and moved from Tongaat to Durban, whereupon Michael was allowed to return to Tongaat and begin the development of the sugar estate. Ruth no longer accompanied Sean on all of his absences from Lady Burke. Her swiftly increasing girth and a mild malady which assailed her in the mornings kept her at Lioncop, where she and Ada spent much time in the design and fabrication of baby wear. In this Storm rendered assistance. The matinee jacket, which took 3 months to knit, was certain to fit the infant perfectly, provided it was a hunchback with its one arm twice as long as the other. Kept busy from early morning to nightfall in the capacity of overseer on Mahuba's Kloof, Dirk found little time for distraction. Lady Burke was now well covered by Sean's espionage system, and Dirk's few visits were reported in detail. But on the far side of Lady Burke, derelict and shabby from want of love, brooded the great homestead of Tunis Kraal. In the night, a single window showed a pale yellow square of light, as Gary Courtney sat alone at his desk. In front of him lay a pathetically thin sheaf of papers. Hour after hour he stared at it, but no longer seeing it. He was dry inside, deprived of the juice of life and seeking its substitute in the bottle, which was always near him. The days drifted into weeks, and they in turn became months, and he drifted with them. Each afternoon he would go down to the paddocks then. Leaning against the heavy wooden paling, he would watch his bloodstock. Hour after hour he stood unmoving, and it seemed that, in time, he left his own body and lived within those richly gleaming skins, as though his own hooves drove deep into the turf as he ran, as though his own voice squealed and his muscles bunched and moved in the savage mating of heavy bodies. Ronnie Pye found him there one afternoon. Without Gary being aware of his presence, he came up silently and stood beside him, studying the pale, intense face with the chisel marks of pain and doubt and terrible yearning sculptured deep around the mouth and below the pale blue eyes. "Hello, Gary," he spoke softly, but recognizing the pity in his own voice, he thrust it aside. There was no room for softness now, and ruthlessness had hardened his resolve. "Ronnie," vaguely Gary turned to him, and when he smiled it was shyly. "Business or social?"
"Business, Gary."
"The bond?"
"Yes."
"What do you want me to do?"
"How about coming into town? We can go over things in my office."
"Now?"
"Yes, please."
"Very well." Gary straightened up slowly.
"I'll come with you."
They rode together over the crest of ground and came towards the concrete bridge over the Baboonstroom, both of them silent. Gary, because there was nothing in him, nothing to give voice to. Ronnie Pye, because of his sense of shame for the thing he was about to do. He was going to take a man's home from him, and turn him loose upon a world in which he would have no chance of survival. At the bridge they stopped automatically to rest their horses, and they sat without speaking, an incongruous pair, one man sitting quietly, slim and wasted, his clothing slightly rumpled, his face austere with suffering, the other plump, red-faced, below bright ginger hair, dressed in expensive cloth, fidgeting in the saddle. There was little sign of life across the river. A long, tired smear of smoke from the wattle factory stack rising straight into the still hot air, a black boy moving cattle down to drink at the river, the huff and clatter and clang of a locomotive shunting in the goods yards. But otherwise the town of Lady Burke lay slumbering in the heat of a summer afternoon. Then, on the open grassy plain below the escarpment, urgent movement caught Ronnie's eye, and he focused his attention upon it with relief. A horseman riding fast, and even at this distance Ronnie recognized him.
A young Dirk, he grunted, and Gary roused himself and peered out across the river. Horse and rider blended into one unit, seeming to touch the earth so lightly they were bound to it only by a pale feather of dust that drifted low behind them.
My God, that little bastard can ride!
In reluctant admiration, Ronnie shook his head solemnly, and a drop of perspiration broke from his hairline and slid down his cheek. The horse reached the road and pivoted neatly, flattening into the increased speed of its run, movement of such rhythmic grace and power that the watchers were stirred.
"Look at him go," whistled Ronnie. "Don't reckon there's anything to catch that horse in the whole of Natal."
"You think so?" Gary's voice was suddenly alive, and his lips were pursed in anger.
"I'm damned certain of it. Mine. My colt. Grey Weather. Over a point-to-point course, I'd match him against any of Sean Courtney's stud."
And those words gave Ronnie Pye the idea. He turned it over in his mind, while with slightly narrowed eyes he watched Dirk Courtney race Sundancer down towards the wattle factory. When horse and rider had disappeared through the tall gates, Ronnie spoke softly.
"Would you back your colt with money?"
"I'd back him with my life." There was savagery in Gary's voice.
"Yes," thought Ronnie. "This way at least I will give him a chance. This way the fates will make the decision. There will be no blame to my account."
"Would you back it with Tunis Kral?" he asked,
and the silence drew out.
"How do you mean?" whispered Gary.
"If you win, the bond on Tunis Kral is set aside."
"And if I lose?"
"You lose the farm."
"No," snapped Gary. "Christ, no, that's too much."
Ronnie shrugged indifferently.
"It was just an idea. You're probably wise. You wouldn't have had much of a chance against Sean."
Gary gasped sharply. That challenge had wounded deep as a lance, made it a direct competition between Sean and himself. To ignore it would be to admit he could never win.
"I'll take the bet."
"The whole bet? You'll cover my money with what you have left of Tunis Kral?"
"Yes, damn you. Yes, I'll show you how much chance I have against him."
"We'd better get it down in writing," Ronnie suggested gently.
"Then I'll see if I can arrange it with Sean."
He touched his mount with his spurs, and they moved forward across the bridge.
"By the way, I think it best we tell nobody about our little bet. We'll pretend it's just an honour match."
Gary nodded his agreement. But that night, when he wrote to Michael, he told him about it, then went on to plead with Michael to ride Grey Weather in the race. 2 days before the competition, Michael confided in his grandmother. Ada went out to Tunis Kral to try and dissuade Gary from this reckless gamble, without success. Gary was almost fanatical in his determination. The stake meant nothing to him. It was the prospect of winning. And now he had Grey Weather and Michael to run for him. This time, he would win. This time.